belief that the planets revolve around the sun, which ignited a scientific revolution in the 1500s that entirely obliterated the Church's long-held teaching that mankind occupied the center of God's universe. His discovery was condemned by the Church for 3 centuries, but the damage had been done, and the world had never been the same.
"I can see you're skeptical," Edmund said. "Would it be better if I said Darwin?"
Langdon smiled. "Same issue."
"Okay, then let me ask you this. What are the 2 fundamental questions that have been asked by the human race throughout our entire history?"
Langdon considered it. "Well, the questions would have to be, how did it all begin? Where do we come from?"
"Precisely. And the second question is simply the ancillary to that. Not where do we come from, but
where are we going?"
"Yes. These 2 mysteries lie at the heart of the human experience. Where do we come from? Where are we going? Human creation and human destiny. They are the universal mysteries."
Edmund's gaze sharpened, and he peered at Langdon expectantly.
"Robert, the discovery I have made, it very clearly answers both of these questions."
Langdon grappled with Edmund's words and their heady ramifications. "I'm not sure what to say."
"No need to say anything. I'm hoping you and I can find time to discuss it in depth following tonight's presentation. But at the moment, I need to talk to you about the darker side of all this, the potential fallout from the discovery."
"You think there will be repercussions?"
"Without a doubt. By answering these questions, I have placed myself in direct conflict with centuries of established spiritual teachings. Issues of human creation and human destiny are traditionally the domain of religion. I'm an interloper, and the religions of the world are not going to like what I'm about to announce."
"Interesting," Langdon replied. "And is this why you spent 2 hours grilling me about religion over lunch in Boston last year?"
"It is. You may remember my personal guarantee to you that in our lifetime, the myths of religion would be all but demolished by scientific breakthroughs."
Langdon nodded. Hard to forget. The boldness of Kirsch's declaration had emblazoned itself word for word in Langdon's eidetic memory. "I do. And I countered that religion had survived advances in science for millennia, and that it served an important purpose in society. And while religion might evolve, it would never die."
"Exactly. I also told you that I had found the purpose of my life, to employ the truth of science to eradicate the myth of religion."
"Yes. Strong words."
"And you challenged me on them, Robert. You argued that whenever I came across a scientific truth that conflicted with or undermined the tenets of religion, I should discuss it with a religious scholar in hopes I might realize that science and religion are often attempting to tell the same story in 2 different languages.
"I do remember. Scientists and spiritualists often use different vocabularies to describe the exact same mysteries of the universe. The conflicts are frequently over semantics, not substance."
"Well, I followed your advice," Kirsch said, "and I consulted with spiritual leaders about my latest discovery."
"Oh?
Are you familiar with the Parliament of the World's Religions?"
"Of course." Langdon was a great admirer of the group's efforts to promote interfaith discourse.
"By chance," Kirsch said, "the Parliament held their meeting outside Barcelona this year, about an hour from my home at the Abbey of Montserrat."
Spectacular spot, Langdon thought, having visited the mountaintop sanctuary many years ago.
"When I heard it was taking place during the same week I had planned to make this major scientific announcement, I don't know, I
wondered if it might be a sign from God."
Kirsch laughed. "Something like that. So, I called them."
Langdon was impressed. "You addressed the entire Parliament?"
"No, too dangerous. I didn't want this information leaking out before I could announce it myself, so I scheduled a meeting with only 3 of them. one representative each from Christianity, Islam, and Judaism. The four of us met in private in the library.
I'm amazed they let you in the library, Langdon said with surprise. I hear that's hallowed ground.
I told them I needed a secure meeting place. No phones, no cameras, no intruders. They took me to that library. Before I told them anything, I asked them to agree to a vow of silence. They complied. To date, they are the only people on Earth who know anything about my discovery.
Fascinating. And how did they react when you told them?
Kirsch looked sheepish. I may not have handled it perfectly. You know me, Robert, when my passions flare. Diplomacy is not my métier.
Yes, I've read that you could use some sensitivity training, Langdon said with a laugh, just like Steve Jobs and so many genius visionaries.
So, in keeping with my outspoken nature, I began our talk by simply telling them the truth, that I had always considered religion a form of mass delusion, and that as a scientist, I found it difficult to accept the fact that billions of intelligent people rely on their respective faiths to comfort and guide them. When they asked why I was consulting with people for whom I apparently had little respect, I told them I was there to gauge their reactions to my discovery so I could get some sense of how it would be received by the world's faithful once I made it public.
Always the diplomat, Langdon said, wincing. You do know that sometimes honesty is not the best policy?
Kirsch waved his hand dismissively. My thoughts on religion are widely publicized. I thought they would appreciate the transparency. Nonetheless, after that, I presented my work to them, explaining in detail what I had discovered and how it changed everything. I even took out my phone and showed them some video that I admit is quite startling. They were speechless.
They must have said something, Langdon prompted, feeling even more curious to know what Kirsch possibly could have discovered.
I was hoping for a conversation, but the Christian cleric silenced the other two before they could say a word. He urged me to reconsider making the information public. I told him I would think about it for the next month.
But you're going public tonight.
I know. I told them my announcement was still several weeks away so they wouldn't panic or try to interfere.
And when they find out about tonight's presentation? Langdon asked.
They will not be amused. One of them in particular.
Kirsch locked eyes with Langdon.
The cleric who convened our meeting was Bishop Antonio Valdespino.
Do you know of him? Langdon tensed. From Madrid?
Kirsch nodded. One and the same.
Probably not the ideal audience for Edmund's radical atheism, Langdon thought. Valdespino was a powerful figure in the Spanish Catholic Church, known for his deeply conservative views and strong influence over the King of Spain.
He was host of the Parliament this year, Kirsch said, and therefore the one I spoke to about arranging a meeting. He offered to come personally, and I asked him to bring representatives from Islam and Judaism.
The lights overhead faded again. Kirsch sighed heavily, lowering his voice further.
Robert, the reason I wanted to speak to you before my presentation is that I need your advice. I need to know if you believe that Bishop Valdespino is dangerous.
Dangerous? Langdon said. In what way?
What I showed him threatens his world. And I want to know if you think I'm in any physical danger from him.
Langdon immediately shook his head. No, impossible. I'm not sure what you said to him, but Valdespino is a pillar of Spanish Catholicism, and his ties to the Spanish royal family make him extremely influential. But he's a priest, not a hitman. He wields political power. He may preach a sermon against you, but I would find it very hard to believe that you are in any physical danger from him.
Kirsch looked unconvinced. You should have seen the way he looked at me as I left Montserrat.
You sat in that monastery's sacrosanct library and told a bishop that his entire belief system is delusional, Langdon exclaimed. Did you expect him to serve you tea and cake?
No, Edmund admitted, but I also didn't expect him to leave me a threatening voicemail after our meeting.
Bishop Valdespino called you?
Kirsch reached into his leather jacket and pulled out an unusually large smartphone. It had a bright turquoise case, adorned with a repeating hexagonal pattern, which Langdon recognized as a famous tiled pattern designed by the modernist Catalan architect Antoni Gaudí.
"Have a listen," Kirsch said, pressing a few buttons and holding up the phone.
An elderly man's voice crackled tersely out of the speaker, his tone severe and dead serious.
"Mr. Kirsch, this is Bishop Antonio Valdespino. As you know, I found our meeting this morning profoundly disturbing, as did my two colleagues. I urge you to call me immediately so we can discuss this further, and I can again warn you of the dangers of going public with this information. If you do not call, be advised that my colleagues and I will consider a preemptive announcement to share your discoveries, reframe them, discredit them, and attempt to reverse the untold damage you are about to cause the world, damage that you clearly do not foresee. I await your call, and I strongly suggest you not test my resolve."
The message ended. Langdon had to admit he was startled by Valdespino's aggressive tone, and yet the voicemail did not so much frighten him as it deepened his curiosity about Edmund's impending announcement. "So, how did you respond?"
"I didn't," Edmund said, slipping the phone back into his pocket. "I saw it as an idle threat. I was certain they wanted to bury this information, not announce it themselves. Moreover, I knew the sudden timing of tonight's presentation was going to take them by surprise, so I wasn't overly concerned about their taking preemptive action." He paused, eyeing Langdon.
"Now, I don't know. Something about his tone of voice. It's just been on my mind."
"Are you worried you're in danger here? Tonight?"
"No, no. The guest list has been tightly controlled, and this building has excellent security. I'm more worried about what happens once I go public."
Edmund seemed suddenly sorry he'd mentioned it.
"It's silly. Pre-show jitters. I just wanted to get your gut instinct."
Langdon studied his friend with mounting concern. Edmund looked unusually pale and troubled. "My gut tells me Valdespino would never place you in danger, no matter how angry you made him." The lights dimmed again, insistently now.
"Okay, thank you."
Kirsch checked his watch.
"I need to go, but can you and I meet later? There are some aspects of this discovery I'd like to discuss further with you."
"Of course."
"Perfect. Things are going to be chaotic after the presentation, so you and I will need someplace private to escape the mayhem and talk."
Edmund took out a business card and started writing on the back.
"After the presentation, hail a cab and give this card to the driver. Any local driver will understand where to bring you."
He handed Langdon the business card. Langdon expected to see the address of a local hotel or restaurant on the back. Instead, he saw what looked more like a cipher. BIO-EC346. "I'm sorry, give this to a taxi driver?"
"Yes, he'll know where to go. I'll tell security there to expect you, and I'll be along as quickly as possible."
"Security?" Langdon frowned, wondering if BIO-EC346 were the code name for some secret science club.
"It's a painfully simple code, my friend."
He winked.
"You of all people should be able to crack it. And, by the way, just so you're not taken off guard, you'll be playing a role in my announcement tonight."
Langdon was surprised. "What kind of role?"
"Don't worry. You won't have to do a thing."
With that, Edmund Kirsch headed across the floor toward the spiral's exit.
"I've got to dash backstage, but Winston will guide you up."
He He paused in the doorway and turned. I'll see you after the event. And let's hope you're right about Valdespino. Edmund, relax. Focus on your presentation. You're not in any danger from religious clerics, Langdon assured him. Kirsch didn't look convinced. You may feel differently, Robert, when you hear what I'm about to say. Chapter 10. The holy seat of the Roman Catholic Archdiocese of Madrid, Catedral de la Almudena, is a robust neoclassical cathedral situated adjacent to Madrid's royal palace. Built on the site of an ancient mosque, Almudena Cathedral derives its name from the Arabic Al-Mudaina, meaning citadel. According to legend, when Alfonso VI seized Madrid back from the Muslims in 1083, he became fixated on relocating a precious lost icon of the Virgin Mary that had been entombed in the walls of the citadel for safekeeping. Unable to locate the hidden virgin, Alfonso prayed intently until a section of the citadel's wall exploded, falling away, and revealed the icon inside, still lit by the burning candles with which she had been entombed centuries ago. Today, the Virgin of Almudena is the patron saint of Madrid, and pilgrims and tourists alike flock to Mass at Almudena Cathedral for the privilege of praying before her likeness. The church's dramatic location, sharing the royal palace's main plaza, provides an added attraction to churchgoers, the possibility of glimpsing royalty coming or going from the palace. Tonight, deep inside the cathedral, a young acolyte was rushing through the hallway in a panic. Where is Bishop Valdespino? Services are about to begin. For decades, Bishop Antonio Valdespino had been head priest and overseer of this cathedral. A longtime friend and spiritual counselor to the king, Valdespino was an outspoken and devout traditionalist with almost no tolerance for modernization. Incredibly, the 83-year-old bishop still donned ankle shackles during Holy Week and joined the faithful carrying icons through the city streets.
Valdespino, of all people, is never late for Mass.
The acolyte had been with the bishop 20 minutes ago in the vestry, assisting him with his robes as usual. Just as they finished, the bishop had received a text and, without a word, had hurried out.
Where did he go?
Having searched the sanctuary, the vestry, and even the bishop's private restroom, the acolyte was now running at a sprint down the hallway to the administrative section of the cathedral to check the bishop's office. He heard a pipe organ thunder to life in the distance.
The processional hymn is starting.
The acolyte skidded to a stop outside the bishop's private office, startled to see a shaft of light beneath his closed door.
He's here?
The acolyte knocked quietly.
Reverendissima? Excellencia?
No answer. Knocking louder, he called out,
Su Excellencia!
Still nothing. Fearing for the old man's health, the acolyte turned the handle and pushed open the door.
Cielos!
The acolyte gasped as he peered into the private space. Bishop Valdespino was seated at his mahogany desk, staring into the glow of a laptop computer. His holy mitre was still on his head, his chasuble wadded beneath him, and his crozier staff propped unceremoniously against the wall. The acolyte cleared his throat.
La Santa Misa está
preparada, the bishop interrupted, his eyes never moving from the screen.
Padre Drida me sustituye.
The acolyte stared in bewilderment. Father Drida is substituting? A junior priest overseeing Saturday night Mass was highly irregular.
Vete ya,
Valdespino snapped without looking up.
Y cierra la puerta.
Fearful, the boy did as he was told, leaving immediately and closing the door as he went. Hurrying back toward the sounds of the pipe organ, the acolyte wondered what the bishop could possibly be viewing on his computer that would pull his mind so far from his duties to God. At that moment, Admiral Avila was snaking through the growing crowd in the Guggenheim's atrium, puzzled to see guests chatting with their sleek headsets. Apparently, the audio tour of the museum was a two-way conversation. He felt glad to have jettisoned the device. No distractions tonight. He checked his watch and eyed the elevators. They were already crowded with guests heading to the main event upstairs, so Avila opted for the stairs. As he climbed, he felt the same tremor of incredulity he had felt last night. Have I really become a man capable of killing? The godless souls who had ripped away his wife and child had transformed him. My actions are sanctioned by a higher authority, he reminded himself. There is righteousness in what I do. As Avila reached the first landing, his gaze was drawn to a woman on a nearby suspended catwalk. Spain's newest celebrity, he thought, eyeing the famous beauty. She wore a form-fitting white dress with a black diagonal stripe that ran elegantly across her torso. Her slender figure, lush dark hair, and graceful carriage were easy to admire, and Avila noticed he was not the only one with eyes on her. In addition to the approving glances of the other guests, the woman in white held the full attention of two sleek security officers who shadowed her closely. The men moved with the wary confidence of panthers and wore matching blue blazers with embroidered crests and the large initials G.R. Avila was not surprised by their presence, and yet the sight of them made his pulse quicken. As a former member of the Spanish Armed Forces, he knew full well what G.R. signified. These two security escorts would be armed and as well-trained as any bodyguards on Earth. If they are present, I must take every precaution, Avila told himself. Hey! A man's voice barked directly behind him. Avila spun around. A paunchy man in a tuxedo and a black cowboy hat was smiling broadly at him. Great costume, the man said, pointing to Avila's military uniform. Where does someone get something like that? Avila stared, fists clenching reflexively. Through a lifetime of service and sacrifice, he thought. No hablo inglés, Avila replied with a shrug, and continued up the stairs. On the second floor, Avila found a long hallway and followed signs to a remote restroom at the far end. He was about to enter when the lights throughout the museum faded off and on, the first gentle nudge, urging guests to start heading upstairs for the presentation. Avila entered the deserted restroom, chose the last stall, and locked himself inside. Alone now, he felt the familiar demons trying to surface within him, threatening to drag him back into the abyss. 5 years, and the memories still haunt me. Angrily, Avila pushed the horrors from his mind and retrieved the rosary beads from his pocket. Gently, he looped them over the coat hook on the door. As the beads and crucifix swung peacefully before him, he admired his handiwork. The devout might be horrified that anyone could defile the rosary by creating an object like this. Even so, Avila had been assured by the regent that desperate times afforded a certain flexibility in the rules of absolution. When the cause is this holy, the regent had promised, God's forgiveness is guaranteed. As with the protection of his soul, Avila's body had also been guaranteed deliverance from evil. He glanced down at the tattoo on his palm. Like the ancient chrismon of Christ, the icon was a symbol constructed entirely of letters. Avila had inscribed it there 3 days ago with iron gall and a needle, precisely as he had been instructed, and the spot was still tender and red. If he were captured, the regent assured him, all he had to do was make his palm visible to his captors, and within hours he would be released. We occupy the highest levels of government, the regent had said. Avila had already witnessed their startling influence, and it felt like a mantle of protection all around him. There still exist those who respect the ancient ways. One day, Avila hoped to join the ranks of this elite, but for the moment, he felt honored to play any role at all. In the solitude of the bathroom, Avila took out his phone and dialed the secure number he had been given. The voice on the line answered on the first ring.
Si.
Estoy en posición.
Avila replied, awaiting final instructions.
Bien,
the regent said.
Tendrás una sola oportunidad. Aprovecharla será crucial.
You will have only one chance. Seizing it will be crucial. Chapter 11. 30 kilometers up the coastline from Dubai's glistening skyscrapers, man-made islands, and celebrity party villas lies the city of Sharjah, the ultra-conservative Islamic cultural capital of the United Arab Emirates. With more than 600 mosques and the region's finest universities, Sharjah stands as a pinnacle of spirituality and learning, a position fueled by massive oil reserves and a ruler who places the education of his people above all else. Tonight, the family of Sharjah's beloved Allama, Sayyid al-Fadl, had gathered in private to hold a vigil. Instead of praying the traditional tahajjud, the night vigil prayer, they prayed for the return of their cherished father, uncle, and husband, who had mysteriously disappeared yesterday without a trace. The local press had just announced that one of Sayyid's colleagues was claiming that the normally composed Allama had seemed strangely agitated upon his return from the Parliament of the World's Religions 2 days ago. In addition, the colleague said he had overheard Sayyid engaged in a rare, heated phone argument shortly after his return. The dispute was in English and therefore indecipherable to him, but the colleague swore he had heard Sayyid repeatedly mention a single name, Edmund Kirsch. Chapter 12. Langdon's thoughts swirled as he emerged from the spiral structure. His conversation with Kirsch had been both exciting and alarming. Whether or not Kirsch's claims were exaggerated, the computer scientist clearly had discovered something that he believed would cause a paradigm shift in the world. A discovery as important as the findings of Copernicus? When Langdon finally emerged from the coiled sculpture, he felt slightly dizzy. He retrieved the headset he had left on the floor earlier. Winston? He said, pulling on the device. Hello? A faint click, and the computerized British docent was back. Hello, Professor. Yes, I'm here. Mr. Kirsch asked me to take you up the service elevator because time is too short to return to the atrium. He also thought you would appreciate our oversized service elevator. Nice of him. He knows I'm claustrophobic. Now, I do too, and I will not forget it. Winston guided Langdon through the side door into a cement hallway and elevator bay. As promised, the elevator carriage was enormous, clearly designed to transport oversized artwork. Top button, Winston said as Langdon stepped inside. Third floor. When they arrived at their destination, Langdon stepped out. Righto, Winston's cheery voice chimed in Langdon's head. We'll go through the gallery on your left. It's the most direct way to the auditorium. Langdon followed Winston's directions through an expansive gallery displaying a series of bizarre art installations. A steel cannon that apparently shot gooey globs of red wax at a white wall. A wire mesh canoe that clearly would not float. An entire miniature city made of burnished metal blocks. As they crossed the gallery toward the exit, Langdon found himself staring in utter bewilderment at a massive piece that dominated the space. It's official, he decided. I've found the strangest piece in this museum. Spanning the width of the entire room, a multitude of timber wolves were dynamically posed, sprinting in a long line across the gallery, where they leaped high in the air and collided violently with a transparent glass wall, resulting in a mounting pile of dead wolves. "It's called head-on," Winston offered, unprompted. 99 wolves racing blindly into a wall to symbolize a herd mentality, a lack of courage in diverging from the norm. The irony of the symbolism struck Langdon. I suspect Edmund will be diverging dramatically from the norm this evening. "Now, if you'll continue straight ahead," Winston said, "you'll find the exit to the left of that colorful diamond-shaped piece. The artist is one of Edmund's favorites." Langdon spotted the brightly colored painting up ahead and instantly recognized the trademark squiggles, primary colors, and playful floating eye. Joan Miró, Langdon thought, having always liked the famous Barcelonan's playful work, which felt like a cross between a child's coloring book and a surrealist stained glass window. As Langdon drew even with the piece, however, he stopped short, startled to see that the surface was utterly smooth, with no visible brushstrokes. "It's a reproduction?"
"No, that's the original," Winston replied.
Langdon looked closer. The work had clearly been printed by a large format printer. "Winston, this is a print. It's not even on canvas."
"I don't work on canvas," Winston replied. "I create art virtually, and then Edmund prints it for me."
"Hold on," Langdon said in disbelief. "This is yours?"
"Yes, I tried to mimic the style of Joan Miró."
"I can see that," Langdon said. "You even signed it, Miró."
"No," Winston said. "Look again. I signed it Miró, with no accent. In Spanish, the word Miró means I look at."
"Clever," Langdon had to admit, seeing the single Miró-style eye looking at the viewer from the center of Winston's piece.
"Edmund asked me to create a self-portrait, and this is what I came up with."
"This is your self-portrait?" Langdon glanced again at the collection of uneven squiggles. "You must be a very strange-looking computer." Langdon had recently read about Edmund's growing excitement for teaching computers to create algorithmic art, that is, art generated by highly complex computer programs. It raised an uncomfortable question. When a computer creates art, who is the artist? The computer or the programmer? At MIT, a recent exhibit of highly accomplished algorithmic art had put an awkward spin on the Harvard Humanities course, "Is Art What Makes Us Human?"
"I compose music, too," Winston chimed. "You should ask Edmund to play some for you later, should you be curious. At the moment, however, you do need to hurry. The presentation is starting shortly."
Langdon left the gallery and found himself on a high catwalk overlooking the main atrium. On the opposite side of the cavernous space, docents were hustling the last few straggling guests out of the elevators, herding them in Langdon's direction toward a doorway up ahead.
"Tonight's program is scheduled to begin in just a few minutes," Winston said. "Do you see the entrance to the presentation space?"
"I do. It's just ahead."
"Excellent. One final point. As you enter, you will see collection bins for headsets. Edmund asked that you not return your unit, but rather keep it. This way, after the program, I will be able to guide you out of the museum through a back door, where you'll avoid the crowds and be sure to find a taxi."
Langdon pictured the strange series of letters and numbers that Edmund had scrawled on the business card, telling him to give it to the taxi driver. "Winston, all Edmund wrote was BIO-EC346. He called it a painfully simple code."
"He speaks the truth," Winston replied quickly. "Now, Professor, the program is about to begin. I do hope you enjoy Mr. Kirsch's presentation, and I look forward to assisting you afterward."
With an abrupt click, Winston was gone. Langdon neared the entry doors, removed his headset, and slipped the tiny device into his jacket pocket. Then he hurried through the entrance with the last few guests, just as the doors closed behind him. Once again, he found himself in an unexpected space. "We're standing up for the presentation?" Langdon had imagined the crowd gathering in a comfortable sit-down auditorium to hear Edmund's announcement, but instead, hundreds of guests stood packed into a cramped, whitewashed gallery space. The room contained no visible artwork and no seating, just a podium at the far wall, flanked by a large LCD screen that read, "Live program begins in 2 minutes, 7 seconds." Langdon felt a surge of anticipation, and his eyes continued down the LCD screen to a second line of text, which he needed to read twice. "Current remote attendees, 1,953,694. 2 million people? Kirsch had told Langdon he would be live-streaming his announcement, but these numbers seemed unfathomable, and the ticker was climbing faster with each passing moment. A smile crossed Langdon's face. His former student had certainly done well for himself. The question now was, what in the world was Edmund about to say? Chapter 13. In a moonlit desert just east of Dubai, a Sand Viper 1100 dune buggy veered hard to the left and skidded to a stop, sending a veil of sand billowing out in front of the blazing headlights. The teenager behind the wheel ripped off his goggles and stared down at the object he had almost run over. Apprehensive, he climbed out of the vehicle and approached the dark form in the sand. Sure enough, it was exactly what it had appeared to be. There in his headlights, sprawled face down on the sand, lay a motionless human body.
"Maraba," the kid called out. "Hello?"
No response. The boy could tell it was a man from his clothing, a traditional shishia hat and loose-fitting thobe. And the man looked well-fed and squat. His footprints had long since blown away, as had any tire tracks or hints as to how he might have gotten this far out into the open desert.
"Maraba?"
the kid repeated. Nothing. Uncertain what else to do, the boy reached out with his foot and gently nudged the man's side. Although his body was plump, his flesh felt taut and hard, already desiccated by the wind and sun. Definitely dead. The boy reached down, grasped the man's shoulder, and heaved him onto his back. The man's lifeless eyes stared up at the heavens. His face and beard were covered in sand, but even dirty, he looked friendly somehow, even familiar, like a favorite uncle or grandfather. The roar of a half-dozen quad bikes and buggies thundered nearby as the kid's dune-bashing buddies circled back to make sure he was all right. Their vehicles roared up over the ridge and slid down the face of the dune. Everyone parked, removed their goggles and helmets, and gathered around the macabre discovery of a parched corpse. One of the boys started speaking excitedly, having recognized the dead man as the famous Allama Sayyid al-Fadl, a scholar and religious leader who spoke from time to time at the university.
"Mata alina an-nafar,"
he asked aloud.
"What should we do?"
The boys stood in a circle, staring silently at the corpse. Then they reacted like teenagers around the world. They pulled out their phones and began snapping photos to text to their friends. Chapter 14. Standing shoulder to shoulder with guests jostling around the podium, Robert Langdon watched in amazement as the number on the LCD screen ticked steadily higher. Current remote attendees, 2,527,664. The background chatter in the cramped space had risen to the level of a dull roar, the voices of hundreds of guests buzzing with anticipation, many making excited last-minute phone calls or tweeting their whereabouts. A technician stepped to the podium and tapped the microphone.
"Ladies and gentlemen, we asked earlier that you please turn off your mobile devices. At this time, we will be blocking all Wi-Fi and cellular communications for the duration of this event."
Many guests were still on their phones, and they abruptly lost their connections. Most of them looked wholly stupefied, as if they had just witnessed some miraculous piece of Kirshian technology capable of magically severing all connection with the outside world. $500 at an electronics store, Langdon knew, being one of several Harvard professors who now used portable cell jamming technology to render their lecture halls dead zones and keep students off their devices during class. A cameraman now moved into position with a massive camera on his shoulder, which he directed at the podium. The room lights dimmed. The LCD screen read, "Live program begins in 38 seconds. Current remote attendees, 2,857,914. Langdon watched the attendee counter with amazement. It seemed to be climbing faster than the U.S. national debt. And he found it nearly impossible to fathom that close to 3 million people were sitting at home at this very moment watching a live stream of what was about to happen in this room.
30 seconds, the technician announced softly into the microphone. A narrow door opened in the wall behind the podium, and the crowd immediately hushed, all looking expectantly for the great Edmund Kirsch. But Edmund never materialized. The door stood open for nearly 10 seconds. Then an elegant woman emerged and moved toward the podium. She was strikingly beautiful, tall and willowy with long black hair, wearing a form-fitting white dress with a diagonal black stripe. She seemed to drift effortlessly across the floor. Taking center stage, she adjusted the microphone, took a deep breath, and gave the attendees a patient smile as she waited for the clock to tick down. "Live program begins in 10 seconds. The woman closed her eyes a moment, as if to gather herself, and then she opened them again, a portrait of poise. The cameraman held up 5 fingers. 4, 3, 2. The room fell completely silent as the woman raised her eyes to the camera. The LCD display dissolved into a live image of her face. She fixed the audience with spirited dark eyes as she casually brushed a strand of hair from her olive-toned cheek.
"Good evening, everyone," she began, her voice cultured and gracious, with a light Spanish accent. "My name is Ambra Vidal."
An unusually loud burst of applause erupted in the room, making it apparent that a good number of people knew who she was.